Welcome everybody to Yushan's Corporate Startup Innovation Series. Today we have a very special guest, Hervé Bhandari, joining us from Paris, but originally based in San Francisco, I believe. And welcome. We also have Volker on board, the managing director from Yushan Ventures. And today's topic is corporate innovation and the human element. So thank you both for joining us. And maybe I'll open up to you, Volker, in regards to how you guys met.
Yeah, thanks for hosting the podcast, Stefan. Hervé, awesome to chat with you. It's been a while. We met like, 15 years ago when we both worked at the phone company, AT&T.
Now you're making both of us sound like we're old.
Wise, I think, is the experience.
And yeah, so you have, as long as I recall, been engaged with transforming workforces, implementing innovation procedures in multinational corporations, while you always have also run your own consulting business, Radical Roamer. And you have been thinking of incredibly innovative approaches such as people living on ships and innovating there, and how you can actually change the scope of innovation in general. So that's what I recall from the day I met you until today. And it would be really nice to hear you just, you know, share your career and your insights around digital transformation. You travel a lot, regional best practices. And then if you have ever done a lot of POCs with corporate and startups. And of course, we're curious in the end to hear your big idea. If you got VC funding tomorrow, what would you would do? Anyway.
That's a lot of questions.
So that's a lot of questions.
That's the outline for today's talk. So let's just start with Hervé.
Well, thank you for having me, guys. I really, really appreciate it. Volker, we've had some amazing conversations over the years. Overall, I feel that let's go back to the human element for a second. That for me, the human element is what pushes me to be innovative. At the end of the day, corporations have their bottom lines and revenues, but they are built out of people, and people are making decisions. And I think being, you know, you talk about me traveling a lot and being a nomad, and I think that started very, very young. I've been moving around my entire life. It gave me different perspectives, so I never got into one, so to say, culture or community. I brought things from different communities and different cultures, and my thought processes were always very different than the people I was in or around, whether that was personally or in a corporation. Early in my career, you know, went the traditional way through marketing and advertising, and realized very, very quickly that even there, you know, I wanted to see more. I wanted to do more. I wanted to create things that were different, that matched with me, because I wasn't static. I wasn't in the static lifestyle. And so even the roles that I started doing in organizations, I think I got to be known as someone who would build out new organizations or help people figure out what resources, people, operations needed to be done in a new organization, because I was willing to take that risk, because for me, there was nothing to lose. So I think at the end of the day, you know, I'm all about the human element. I think if I were to sum it up, what I did in corporations, more so than even creating the processes and the operations and everything like that, it was helping other people see things differently so that they could make decisions that could affect people or their end consumer and customer based on everybody being human versus it's just about generating another dollar.
Mm-hmm. Irvi, you're modest. You have worked at amazing companies, not only AT&T, but it's mighty IBM, the Coca-Cola company, the Jones Apparel Group. You work for an advertising agency. You worked most recently for an Indian outsourcing giant, Wipro, correct?
Yep, Wipro.
Mm-hmm. And so what are the differences that you saw across borders, across cultures within these corporations and the human element? Does it, how does the human elephant element? How does that affect? I was thinking of corporates. They're often considered as the dinosaurs or elephants in the room, right? In terms of startups in the context. But how does the human element affect the people that don't want to change? I'm thinking of the not invented here syndrome, for instance, which we always discuss. But how can you actually impact those people that are really stagnant? Or do companies have to wait till they retire? Is there any way to use the...
Interestingly enough, that was something I started talking about 4 or 5 years ago, is that one of the things companies need to do is find a way. You know how we used to have career counselors when we were in high school, right? To tell us what classes we should be taking, where we could be doing. I mean, in high school, you have no idea what opportunities you have out there. You know, you only get exposed to what people in your family or people on TV or, you know, whatever. Those are the jobs that you know about. But we know that there are millions of types of jobs out there that could be perfect for certain people. But I think that one of the things corporations need to do is have that career counselor and say, hey, you know what? We see trends happening. You have a certain skill set, but however, you have experience, you have loyalty, right? I mean, you don't have to tell that to the employee, but as a company, you're thinking they have loyalty with the company. Hey, why don't we reskill them? And I think you're seeing that a little bit in the media now, that people are talking about companies reskilling. Actually, AT&T put something in about a year ago about reskilling their employees, because their employees have been there for a very long time. The problem with the human element piece is that, look, your leaders become leaders because they have it internally in them that they have this motivation, ambition, whatever you want to call it. But if we look at mass society does want to be led. So why don't we lead them in a positive manner that motivates them as an individual, because we are providing them the support to be able to match with the changes, the paradigm shifts that are happening. Right. And so now we're creating a positive for the individual. But at the end of the day, even as a corporation, you're creating a positive because you're keeping people who are loyal and who will do good work because you know that they have the ability to do it. We just need to reskill them.
Mm-hmm. Interesting element. Yeah. OK. Stefan.
One question. When you talked at the beginning, you said what you do. It sounds very interesting, but it also sounds, it's hard to wrap your head around it. So is there any kind of practical example that you can say, look, this is what we, without maybe mentioning a company, but this is what the problem was, this is kind of the steps we took to address it, and this is kind of the, I think a practical example is always interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So I guess you could say, so from people perspective. So one of the last roles, and I can probably give this because, I mean, this is a role that I did and people knew I did this role. But so at AT&T, when we were, last role I did was doing innovation within entertainment, media, sports, and hospitality. And what that meant was that as a person who was a marketer and as a person who was a storyteller, I was brought in to help the sales team sell ideas that they wouldn't be actually, and I said ideas, not the actual product, that they wouldn't actually be able to sell for another 4 or 5 years. And when you look at a sales team, they don't have 4 or 5 year sales cycles. Their numbers are every quarter. So you're telling a strategy person to sit in a sales organization, manage salespeople, and, oh, by the way, we're telling stories for 4 or 5 years in the future. So, you know, I'm working with salespeople who are good at what they do, who are good at selling the product and network systems now. And part of my role was to go in and you know, granted, I was also on a sales kind of, I guess you could say, pay scale. However, what I did do is I asked them to keep my salary whole and not necessarily give me too much upside for the sales, because I said, I'm not going to be making these sales right now. This is, you're telling me to do strategy for 4 or 5 years in the future. However, this is what I need you to, I need you to figure out some way to also keep my salespeople whole, because they are going to be, they're looking at their quarterly numbers, right? And so part of it was, is being able to, the person who is helping doing the innovation has to be able to see ahead a little bit and put process in place to make sure that people continue to get motivated by whatever it is they're motivated by, right? Because I'm not a salesperson. I don't get motivated by a sales upside. I get motivated by, I get to tell the story. I get to create the future, even if it doesn't happen until 4 or 5 years in the future. Now, what we were doing at that time was, examples were, you know, stadiums. Stadiums did not have Wi-Fi. Oh, this was, I mean, this is like now six, 7 years ago. So if you think about 6, 7 years ago, the sports stadiums were not an immersive experience that we talk about today. And we were telling that story 6, 7 years ago to get the stadiums to actually buy Wi-Fi, so that when all the devices eventually became such a big part about sports and an immersive experience, stadiums didn't lose their clientele because they didn't have Wi-Fi and people couldn't be on their devices, right? So we were trying to prevent something happening in the future, but also getting the stadiums to understand they were the ones that were going to become the platform for their fans to have an immersive experience.
Now, how hard is it to get kind of the buy-in from everybody? Because I assume people bring you in because somebody realized, hey, there's a problem. But
yes.
I think getting that from one person to having the buy-in from all the relevant departments must be tough, at least from my experience.
It is actually hard. I will actually say one of the big things that I'm very good at doing is building relationships. At the end of the day, most people I connect to, I could reach out to people I connected to 10 years ago and they will still remember our conversation. I think one of the things that makes me good at what I do is that when I meet a person, again, going back to the human element, right? When I meet a person, I'm very real. There's not a lot of fluff in the conversation. I mean, I get to know people's family, and, or actually part of it is I'm very open about, hey, this is me. You know, if I were single, I'm single. Or, hey, I have a partner right now. I have these two kids in my life. This is how my life used to be. This is where I am right now. This is what we're doing this weekend, blah, blah. You know, I talk about the real everyday stuff with people, instead of having surface level conversations on how's life, you know, or how's the weather, right? And I think what happens is that, especially in organizations like AT&T, I was there for 7.5 years. So when I got into a new role and I knew that other organizations need to collaborate with me, I already had the relationships in those organizations. And now it was me making sure I told the right story so that they understand why they should get involved and what's the benefit to them. So I think there's two pieces to it, right? One is relationship building, but even if people don't have relationships, if you, again, it's seeing in the future and saying, why is something a benefit to the person that you're asking to get engaged? Right? Not just what is the work involved, because that's what they're first going to think is like, oh my God, this is too much work. But it's getting them to get over that and thinking, wait, what is the benefit to me, to my organization, to the company? You know, you start with me because that's where you're going to get them engaged.
What differences did you see working for the Indian multinational corporation versus for all the US, for Fortune 10 companies you have worked for?
Yeah, especially with the no fluff attitude, right? Because I can imagine that.
Exactly. I think probably some of the big, so one of the biggest things probably was process. What I mean by that is in the companies, US companies that I worked for, if you had a process, you could get things done. You know, granted, I think the major issues would be mostly if people had an issue with something fundamentally, but the process would still work, right? Whereas, and again, I'm only using one example, one company, right? So the last company that I worked for Wipro, I will say one of my biggest issues was not the people. The people were actually super smart, great ideas, but where I felt for me personally, because in a work situation, I'm very structured, is that the process was broken, I guess you could say. And I can give an example, which is to get anything done required multiple follow-ups. And even though there was a process, it could take weeks and months to get something done. And it wasn't because a person fundamentally had an issue with something. It's just the process was broken. Versus in a US corporation, the process is not broken. You have people issues, right? So it's a catch-22. I mean, which would you rather be in, right? I mean, but both of those things do stop you to move forward. So it's not like Wipro's any worse than a US company or US company's worse. It's not even bad or good. It's just, these are the, like you said, what are the differences? Well, this is one huge difference between both types of companies.
So that's interesting. I just wonder, you know, spending a lot of time in Germany and me being from Germany, and I'm calling Berlin right now in this call. Germans are all about process, and I think they have really good people. So ideally, the German company should be in the perfect position, right? You said in the US, people are the strength, and then, or the other way around, you said the process is
broken. Better, yeah, and the people, yeah.
Correct. Anyways, yes, so, Stefan.
Yes, another question. How then, if you identify the problem, I mean, that's half the battle, but how can you address it? Or is it even possible, especially if you have big corporations, to change the culture so radically down throughout the company? I mean, that's not a one-day project, right? That's
a multi-year kind of effort. It isn't actually a one-day project, and that's where a couple of things have happened. So obviously I've worked for very large corporations. I've also left very large corporations. One example is, you know, Walmart is a behemoth of a company. And, you know, they are doing good for those people in the small cities by offering, you know, products that otherwise, you know, because they're such mass scale, they can take products to smaller cities. I mean, to me, I think of Walmart as more of your small city retail store that you get everything. You know, it's at the end of the day, it is middle America. It is, and not just middle America, right? They've gone to India, mass populations, right? We're trying to get products to mass populations again. As a minimalist, fundamentally, you know, Walmart kind of went against my grain, which is part of the reason I also left. You know, it wasn't that it was Walmart itself, but one of the other second reasons why I left Walmart, which I haven't really talked about, which is the fact that the innovation that I do and the way that I want to change culture and making people think differently is going to take a long time at Walmart. Right? For many reasons. One, they're in Bentonville, Arkansas. You know, it is a small town, you know, and yet, but at the end of the day, but that is their market. Their market isn't a big city, right? So, you know, just for me as an individual, I am a big city girl. I'm a global person. So, you know, it just didn't match. You know, that's not a bad thing. You know, the fact that the innovation that's going to happen in the smaller cities is going to take some time, and which is fine. And other people can do that. For me, I want to go out there and do stuff that's happening now, and not just now, but things 4 or 5 years in the future versus 10, 12 years in the future.
Yeah, I mean, it's it's all not very easy. One question I had in regards to the human element and pushing innovation. What do you think is the key to that, or how do you how do you get people to realize that that's really the important part, that the humans, that or the human element, that they are the ones that bring you forward, that they are the ones that have all this innovation mm-hmm. kind of inside them. You just need to unlock them and give them the space and the freedom to do it. But how exactly. do you get the big CEOs that are, you know, they're thinking about different things on different levels. How do you get them to realize that?
So Volker mentioned earlier, so my company is actually Radical Roamer, and that's actually what I do. And so I'll kind of give you a methodology of how do you get individuals to think differently. Part of it is self-awareness, right? So I mean, we're talking about the human element here. So helping those executives truly look deep inside, which a lot of them don't want to do. They're doing what they think they want to do, and the ambition and the motivation and the revenue and the money and, you know, supporting their families and, you know, blah, blah. And then I could go on, right? And it's just following. It's following a path, right? And so a lot of people, especially boomers and Gen X, don't realize that they're still following a path, but there is no more path. Right. And so part of it is self-awareness and understanding, okay, but who is it that I really want to be? Then you add in what is happening in the outside world. And if I continue on this path, do I actually have a future? Because even the most successful folks today, if they continue thinking that they can be successful just the way they've been, they will not be successful, because the world is going to change. I mean, millennials and the next generations are changing things very, very quickly. But it's not just them, right? It's the technology too. I mean, even for us as Gen X and you know, people that we may know that are boomers and stuff, the technology has changed how we live, work, and play. Boomers are still in the workforce. Boomers are about, in the next 5 years, you will see more boomer companies come out in the media versus the millennials. Because the boomers are like, I'm sorry, we're still alive. We're still very much active and mentally active and physically active. And you know what? The infrastructure is not there for us. Right. So, sorry, I'm going a little bit of tangent from the methodology, but why I'm saying all these things, we're living longer, right? So you go through the self-awareness, you have to figure out who you are first without any external factors, not even your family and all that. And I really get people to go deep down there. I mean, granted, I'm giving a full methodology versus what I would, you know, what I've been doing with the corporates. But next thing is you then expose those same executives to things that they would never otherwise be exposed to. Who would think that the biggest CEOs and executives out there are exposed to everything? They're not. They're reading about their industry. They're reading about their peers. They have a family. They are a mother, brother, father, sister, brother, you know, whatever. But they don't bring all of that to their job. When they come to their job, they have horse blinders on and they only focus on whatever they're supposed to do. But the fact of the matter is those same executives need to bring their entire self to the table and be a human, which is why. So again, from a more practical perspective, right? When I've worked with people, I am human from day one, right? I am this person. I am this. I have a partner. I have two kids. I have blah, blah. I bring that to the table because it's like, no, we're not just working and building a product or service or whatever, and we have to sell it. It's you and I are human. Our consumer, our client is a human. You know, everyone we're working with is human. So why aren't we playing upon the human element, right? And what we are at the core.
Now, I don't think you've worked in the car industry yet, but as an outsider and taking this kind of things into consideration, yeah. Is there anything that's jumping out of you when you see the mistakes are being made, or where you would kind of urge car companies or people in that sector to kind of, push more or be more human? Exactly.
Yeah, no, it's interesting to me because as much as I'm the tech person, for me personally, a car has always felt like a burden. The best story I can tell you is, so I came to Paris yesterday, as I mentioned, and today is Thursday in Paris, Wednesday still out in the U.S. But on Monday, I returned my car. It was a lease. I had leased it when I started with Walmart 3 years ago, because in Bentonville, taking an Uber for 2 miles is $20. That was going to be an expensive transportation. I was like, I'd rather pay for a car. So I got a car, right? And it's so funny because many times in my life, okay, so I've been driving for about 20 years. I've only had a car for maybe half of that time, on and off. And every time I got a new car, I was like, ooh, new technology? Oh, this is so cool. I'm a technologist, right? But because I didn't necessarily have a car, I wasn't paying attention to it. In terms of what we're going to in the future, I think this mentality of, I think car companies need to understand that we're going to move more and more away from people, mass society, wanting to own a car. Right? And so therefore, does the automotive industry become like public transportation? Or is it, you know, the gig economy, which is the Ubers and the, you know, autonomous vehicles and ride sharing, right? The gig economy. Like, so where does the automotive industry go? Because that will actually determine what technologies we actually need and how people start using transportation. Actually, another thing to think about for transportation on the automotive industry is, so we have big cities like Silicon Valley. So I'm going to use Silicon Valley as an example, or even Dallas, right? Or any big city. We know how much people sit in traffic. Why are they sitting in traffic? They're sitting in traffic because they're working so far away. They're living far away from where they work. That's because wherever they work, the cost of living must be much, much higher, or there's not the right schools or whatever. And so people commute. Okay. With remote ability for working becoming bigger and bigger, how does that change people using automotives or autos? Or with people going back to the fact that, no, we want people to work in the office, right? I mean, there's all these other things, factors that need to actually get involved in the auto industry to actually decide how do we use autos. Pollution, for sustainability perspective, you know, yes, there are companies. Tesla's biggest thing was he wanted to change the fact that he wanted to create cars that were not creating the pollution, right? You know, at the end of the day, he still had to, you know, he has to make cars, he has to make money, but his real fundamental thing was, I want to change the trajectory of the auto industry in terms of sustainability, right? So I think from the auto industry, you know, as we implement more and more digital transformation, is it, you know, are we doing gadgets and gadgets that are just, ooh, cool? Or are we actually enhancing people's lives from a perspective of being a family person and the executive or a worker or whatever, right? I think the auto industry is going to have to dig a little bit deeper. And, you know, again, it's a big industry and we've been living a certain way ever since the roads have been built. Cars became a way of life. But how much is that way of life changing? I mean, by the way, it's totally random, but this is another way to think about it. I don't know if you guys have seen The Time Machine, the movie. Okay. Anyway, long story short, the guy goes millions and millions of years in the future. And in the future, the people are living on rocks. Like, their houses are these, I guess you could say, baskets off of rocks. And transportation is through water. There's no roads anymore. You know? Again, I know I'm going way out there, but I guess part of what I do is I get people to think so extreme so that they can move forward even one step. Because unless you can make people think because I'm the extremist, right? But to, again, going back to the innovation, how do you get people to think differently? Part of it is exposing them to other things, but part of them is making them understand that there are people out there thinking extremes of where we could be going. And a lot of it could be is actually true, because 10, 20 years from now, things will change. But in the meantime, people need to start making those changes today and be a part of it. Otherwise, you're going to be left behind.
No, of course. Maybe I have a couple more questions. I don't know, Volker, if you have any right now.
No, go for it.
Go for it. In terms of big corporates and startups and developing pilot projects, mm-hmm. et cetera, or proof of concepts, what has been your experience, or have you had any experience in that field?
Yeah, so again, the innovation that we were doing, entertainment, media, sports, and hospitality at AT&T, one of the things that was my charter was figuring out, are there companies out there that we should be working with, buying, merging, investing, whatever, as we were building out, you know, fan experiences and, you know, in stadiums or, you know, we were talking, you know, it's funny because if you think about 6-7 years ago, we did not have digital keys for our hotel rooms. And we were talking about that 6-7 years ago. Today, it's like, oh, yeah. Yeah, that's pretty normal. But 6-7 years ago, it was so foreign to people, you know? Again, what was AT&T's role in this? AT&T's role was to sell the network. Hey, hotels, stadiums, you need Wi-Fi, right? But for us, part of it was also, okay, if we're selling that baseline Wi-Fi and the fan experience is digital, we need to be working with mobile app companies. Right? AT&T is not a mobile app company. So part of my job had been is to find companies that we could work with that did do mobile apps and they were versed in creating fan experiences and stuff like that. So we actually did find a couple of Austin-based companies. They were creating fan experiences. We were part of their brainstorming. They were part of us being able to brainstorm what story we can tell our customers, trying to do deals together, you know, going into a client together to say, hey, yeah, it is about the network, but hey, here's the app that you could be building along with it for your fan. And so those were kind of pilot POC projects. They did very well. I think over time, again, I was in that role for about two and a half years. And so a lot of things didn't happen till like 4 years later. One example is the AT&T Stadium. Instead of just the sales team trying to sit and sell the Wi-Fi network, I was able to bring in the marketing team because I knew the marketing team and said, hey, you guys are trying to get them to spend money. No, sorry. We're spending money to put the AT&T name on the stadium. Hey, the sales team is trying to get them to spend money to buy our network, right? So there's this whole money thing going on. Why don't we work collectively to create an experience, right? So not only AT&T, but the stadium is powered by AT&T, not just it's an AT&T, because you know that a lot of the sponsorships for stadiums, it's just a sponsorship. It is not that there's anything that company is really doing inside of the stadium. It's just a sponsorship. Sponsorship is just money and name. Right. But why don't we create a full on, hey, the AT&T stadium is not only the AT&T stadium, it is powered by AT&T. Right. So the network inside of there is AT&T. Your fan experience at the end of the day, the platform is from AT&T. And now you're creating a whole different dimension to what sponsorship and us selling product to a company is. And so those were the pilots that we were doing at the time. And so we had to, you know, obviously both teams had to convince, you know, the Cowboys Stadium. It was the Cowboys Stadium at the time and then became AT&T Cowboys Stadium. To be able to say, this is a whole entire story, right? But that was done through pilots because we were doing pilots with smaller places that we were able to find. By the time we got to the stadium, we were able to have a solid story to say. And that part of that was the learnings from pilots that we were doing.
there was a more holistic approach to the sponsorship deals or the naming rights deals.
Yes, exactly. But again, going back to the original question, which is pilots and stuff, right? Because we were able to gain that knowledge because we were doing pilots with smaller stadiums or smaller venues and things like that, to be able to go to the stadium and say, hey, this is what's happening. This is where we're going to go.
What you're describing, what you experienced with a phone company, is exactly what the automotive industry is experiencing today. They're challenged to create services that will create incremental revenues, but also a better experience for the passenger in the vehicle and for the driver. Right. So it's exactly fast forward what you did for one industry, another industry is experiencing today. So Radical Roamers experiences, I think, would be incredibly valuable for the automotive industry in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, and you, Volker, you bring up a really, really great point is, you know, what was done in one industry is now happening in another industry, in a, you know, in different ways. And that's the thing. That's the whole point of what I want to bring for Radical Roamer to companies, is the fact that my job is to show you what has happened somewhere else, but not only what has happened, but just showing the changes and exposing people, and not just exposing people, you know, to the concepts, actually introducing people to other people so that they can actually experience the change by having conversations, by having, you know, experiences. You know, I want to bring people together so that it's not just a I don't want to do conferences. I actually want people to be in immersive experiences with other people that they would otherwise not meet from a human perspective, and be able to experience, oh, wait, this person thinks very, very differently and has done X, Y, Z, and this is why they've done that, right? But you cannot... An executive cannot learn this stuff. They have to experience it. All of us have to experience something for it to become part of our psyche, which is why for me, you know, if I take clients on, it's not a one-time session or a one-time event. It's, hey, you're going to work with me for at least 6 months, if not a year, because I'm going to curate your life for you at the end of the day, right? That's what I'm doing. I'm curating their life to expose them to what is what other things that they're not getting currently exposed to.
Two more questions. And I think one ties in quite nicely into this. So talking about experiences. So I just have I have two young kids, one boy and one girl. And ever since that, or even more since I had the girl, what you realize is kind of how certain parts of the world or industries are so dominated by one gender versus the other. And I think this is quite true when you talk about tech, AI, automotive, and upper level in corporates. And I think it's just such a, to me, there's such a hole. If you only have one group of people developing products, there's so much that you miss. So I think I wanted to see how you see it as a woman. I know you talk about a lot about women leadership. How you see that, if you also see that hole, and if there may be something that's being addressed to it, to make it go away a little bit.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I mean, I'm going to go to a different perspective than a lot of people go through, which I think we actually need to move more towards gender neutral society. In the sense that we need to stop talking about gender. I mean, and this is as a female, I'm saying this. I'm also very supportive of women in general, but I also work with a lot of men, or I have worked with a lot of men over my career. Part of it is building self-confidence for women and getting us to a point where we are creating that self-confidence for women when they're younger. And I think the millennials and the newer generations, it's happening. But I know for especially a lot of Gen X and boomers, it's not happening until they're in their 40s and 50s. And part of it is culture, is society, you know, these gender norms that we have everywhere. And that's part of the reason I say that we need to go gender neutral, because part of it is, again, even since, I mean, deeper topics, but what is considered roles by different genders is changing, you know, as a holistic, you know, society, which is allowing women to also be more confident and be out there. And to be honest, women lead differently than men, and society has taught women that, no, we have to be like men. Right. And that's part of the reason why I say we need to go gender neutral, because why aren't we looking, again, let's go back to the human element, right? It doesn't matter what gender you are. The fact of the matter is, some of the core fundamentals of us as a human are the same, you know, both men and women want, not necessarily, I wouldn't say companionship necessarily, but they want people that they can engage with, right? And when I say engagement, I'm talking about ways that make them feel good, that they get energy back and they can give energy, right? The give and take of being human. And that doesn't matter what gender you are, right? At the end of the day, the differences happen because people have different experiences. People have different ways of thinking. You know, the need. Now, biologically, yes, needs are different, right, from a man and a woman. But at the end of the day, they're still human. So I think what we need to start doing is building confidence in women, teaching men to be, you know, be accepting of women, but more so, I think long term, I think we need to go gender neutral.
Wow, very, very provocative, and as you always are. Really, how can our listeners contact you if they would like to get in touch with you?
My website is the best way to contact me. It's www.urvib.com. So URVIB.com. So it's basically my first name and my last name, first initial, .com.
Cool. And last question, I think Volker's favorite question, is the question is, if tomorrow you were to start a new business or could start a new startup, what would it be and why? And
what would,
what would be, or what service would you be wanting to offer?
So I do have grandiose plans for Radical Roamer, as usual. I always have grandiose plans. They start small. You know, so as I said, Radical Roamer is about connecting people from a human element perspective. I think as that grows and builds, you know, being able to maybe put a little bit of technology in there, but be able to scale it to, you know, more cities, more people, more executives. I mean, my world is interesting that I come from the corporate world, but I'm so focused on that human element part. And I really do have that mission to make sure that corporations are truly human, and look at that, because that's where the world is going. So I would probably continue to build out Radical Roamer. And of course, as Volker mentioned very briefly in the beginning, my Floating Cities was a 20-year project that started about 6 years ago. So I'm 6 years in and I've got like 14 more years to build my floating city. And so I would continue. So actually, let me put this out there. What I would do is I would pick that investment and I would buy an island and I would create a living lab. And what I mean by that is a living lab where people live, work, and play, and they can come for short amounts of time, long amounts of time. But my folks that I know, the people that I know that are creating tomorrow, would integrate technology into this living lab that corporate executives could come to, be immersed in and live in for a short amount of time, do their work, but get exposed to what could be the possibilities, and then take that technology back to the real world. But in the meantime, they're getting exposed to technology and people and experiences that they can then take back to the real world.
So, yeah, so basically challenging them. Yeah, yeah, it's amazing. So awesome.
As always, Irvi, amazing.
And I would be on my island. I would not be in the real world anymore. I would finally be in my world.
I hope once you have the island, we get a chance to visit.
Absolutely.
And I think on that note, that's a perfect place to end. Irvi, thank you so much for taking the time. Thank you so much for helping us. And
thank you.
Maybe we hope you enjoyed the series. And we hope you join us next time on the next episode of the Yushan Corporate Startup Innovation Series. I know it's a long title, but...
It has been very fun.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And until next time, everybody.